We are absolutely overjoyed and very honoured to have Simon Crafar with us once again. Man, how wonderful it is to see you, and how I'm so grateful you actually decided to come back and talk to us after last time.
Yeah, no problem, buddy. I had a ball, and I keep up with your shows. Always enjoy them. Get a giggle,
man. And, how good?
I'm proud that you got me on it.
How good was the 1,000th MotoGP?
Without exaggeration, I think it is the best atmosphere I've ever felt at a GP. You know, it was amazing. That straight up was really good. And we were super lucky, you know, because everything else was there. I mean, the race was amazing. The crowd was going off. The numbers, the way that the French promoter handled them and the guy on the PA was winding them up. And so all that was right. But the other thing we were super lucky on is I spoke to a colleague who stayed another day there to finish some work, and he said it was 10 degrees colder yesterday.
Wow.
And pissing with rain.
Yep.
So we were super, super lucky.
Well, Trichy could have got a win.
Well, Le Mans normally does toss up rain, and to see blue skies, a high wire act. I mean, I thought, how are the French going to beat the Can-Can girls? And they did it. It was a high wire act. Although that was spectacular. It was so good. It was honestly, it's hugely enjoyable to watch that from afar, and to think we could never do that in Australia, right? We'd ever do.
No, hey, I was thinking about atmospheres that is, you know, were the best that I've ever experienced, and the among the top of the list, if not the top of the list, is standing on the podium at Phillip Island with the crowd invasion. You know, next to in second next to the world champ, McDoohan, and the crowd just going off. That, to me, that is, along with the first time I ever did Suzuka, and there was something like close to 200,000 people there.
Yep.
You know, I was way down the back of the field, you know, my first race internationally, but the atmosphere, incredible at night. And so those were my two favourites before this weekend.
All right, let's talk racing now, because obviously we're all hugely interested in your insights, which are absolutely amazing. What are you thinking this far along into the season in terms of the teams and how they're positioning themselves? Are you seeing anything developing here? What's your take on the season so far?
Oh, take on the season so far. Are you meaning like in general, technically? I mean, okay.
Yeah, technically.
It's obvious. It's obvious for everyone to see Honda continuing their
descent, you know, descent into hell. It's awful.
It is awful. And, you know, only really rescued by the brilliance of Rins in America.
Yeah.
And
the return of Mark. You
know, and the return of Mark on the weekend. Wow. Like,
he's
unbelievable.
Amazing, isn't he?
He's
amazing. I was just saying in our other podcast that we just recorded, our normal one, that obviously he didn't finish the race, but he brings his A game every single time. And you know that if you finish in front of Marc Márquez, you have ridden the wheels off your motorcycle.
I've got to say, I love how deep he digs always. You know, if you're looking at it purely from a sports person's point of view, you know, he's just, you got to admire him, you know. Whether or not you like him or not, that's up to you. But admire him, I can't help it.
Well, that's the thing, you know. I was never a huge fan of Casey Stoner, you know, you just didn't like him, but I could admire the hell out of the way he rode motorcycles. And
exactly,
you could compartmentalize that stuff, you know, quite easily. But yeah, watching Márquez on the weekend, and you know, the commentators were talking about like the second coming of Christ. Mark's back, and it was like the second coming of Christ. He came back and just blew people away.
He never fails to astound me, and I'm not exaggerating. You know, I didn't expect him to do that, but I didn't expect him to do it at Portimao, and I should know that he's going to do something, you know, astounding. But the way I put it on the After the Flag show is just how I, you know, it's just my honest feeling. It was like watching a a boxer, you know, a champion boxer, return after 2 months off, you know, injuries, come in there and he's fighting everyone, tooth and nail, swinging at everyone. And he's got a ball and chain around his ankle in, you know, in the shape of a Honda, you know, trying to hold him back, and he's still fighting.
That's a great analogy. His fighting spirit is not to be denied. It's just amazing. But
there's been, while we're on Honda, there's been a lot of talk about the Calix chassis and even the fact that Mark came back and rode a bike that he hasn't even tested. I mean, that in itself is incredible. But I said in our last show that I reckon Honda's in the hole for 2 years. So you look at the KTM project and the Aprilia project, it's taken them 4 years, 5 years to get to where they are. And Honda is, you feel like they're so far behind at the moment. The other guys are crashing just trying to come 10th. So how long do you think this is going to take for them to solve this? Can they solve it?
Well,
I mean, you don't ride Honda often.
That's a good question. And the hopeful side of me points to 12 months ago at Le Mans was when I was listening to debriefs. I listened to the rider debriefs for, you know, everyone's MotoGP after every day on track. And I was like, wow, the Honda complaints, you know, from their riders are very similar. It's like deja vu when you listen to the KTM complaints. And that is not surprising when you know the history, you know, like how KTM came into the sport. At the time, Honda was the bike to beat. They built very close to a Honda, but the KTM way, you know, meaning if overlaid the two bikes, you'd go, wow, they're similar, you know what I mean? And they hired a whole lot of Honda staff to do it, and they were in the hole 12 months ago, you know, really deep, just like I would say at the deepest point, and at the same time. And what I did was, like, anyone would listen, I would say, this is super interesting. They're two great manufacturers, you know, the sporting giants. Let's see who digs their way out of this hole first. I just was waiting, watching for signs of going forward out of this hole. And obviously, well, the one to me that was clear was it took a long time. Last race, when Brad last year, you know, at Valencia, had that new chassis, and that you can rely on him to squeeze everything out of it, what he's got. And he was the fastest man on track. And I was like, oh, they've got something. They're going forward. You know, that's the first sign. And then they worked over winter. And, wow, what they've turned up with. You know, they worked on everything. Every aspect they've gone and redone it and gone forward. So that gives me hope, you know, to answer your question, that for me, from the deepest, darkest point, you know, it was less than 12 months for turning it around, you know what I mean? So basically, 12 months later, they are one of the contenders, you know? So
Simon, do you, just on that point, I'm fully aware that the Danny Pedrosa is a major factor for KTM as a test rider.
For sure.
So who does Honda have apart from Marquez who can bring that level of – and, you know, Marquez is not a test rider. He's a racer.
That's a really good
you know,
point.
Because who have they got? The German guy, right? They keep wheeling him in.
I mean,
Bradle, yeah.
I really respect him. I do respect
absolutely.
Him. You know, like, it's getting harder and harder for him to show any speed now. But, you know, when he was jumping in all the time over the last couple of years, he was quite impressive, meaning lap time-wise. He wasn't, considering he was a tester and he jumped on Mark's bike. The thing is, what I do know is Danny is super sensitive, you know. And that has to help. That's why they hired him, because he's so sensitive, you know, feels everything. At the same time, I think, look, this is only my opinion, but I think it gets blown up as well. Like, you know, because Danny is such a hero, a legend.
Well, he's an alien. He was one of the original aliens.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah, and you've got him on your side. You're right. And when he goes and tries something, you get an answer.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. And you can see it in the lap time, and you're dead right, you know? So you can't big that up too much. But,
On Honda side,
on the technical bit, my gut feeling over the last months You know, since winter testing till now, I've been thinking that the heart of a motorcycle, this is my opinion, let's see if it comes true. The heart of a motorcycle is the engine. You ride a bike and the whole character comes from that. And yes, it's changed a little bit by chassis and electronics and blah, blah, but and tyres, of course. But the heart of a motorcycle is the engine. And no matter what Honda do, I've seen them change everything and still has no rear grip. And then, so I started digging on this and I started asking all the clever engineers that will talk to me about this. I'm like, it's got to be the engine because they change everything else and nothing fixes it. And so I got a good answer out of one engineer. He said to me, Simon, the engine is 80% of your grip. The delivery, the engine delivery character is 80% of your rear grip. Okay. If you have that wrong, you doesn't matter what chassis, what suspension, what electronics you change, you will never fix the problem. You have to first of all get the engine right, and then you can help it a little bit with the other things, but a small percentage. So 80%. So that answer to me, I know I was looking for it, but is confirmation to me of what I believe. I think Honda, like also like Yamaha, have focused on power, and my wife's just leaving, so see you, sweetie. Not forever, I hope.
Yeah, we always think that when they walk out the door, is she going to come back?
Yeah, no, fucking blame her.
Please come back. Fuck, I'm useless without you.
Yeah, true. That's the truth. Hey, so, I know I'm talking too much, but the last.
No, you're not. No, it's fascinating.
I think that Yamaha and Honda are focusing on trying to catch up power-wise, or at least they have been till now, and they have improved their power. Their power is close, but the delivery of it is shit compared to the opposition. You know?
This could be the fault for all this could clearly be laid at Ducati's doorstep because they built a bike. Yeah. Everyone was going, that's just hosing us down the straits. We need to do something. Put more power in it. And as you said, last time we spoke, you know, racers always want more power, more power, more power. So yeah, you can make these 700 horsepower engines, but it won't turn. It won't get the power down properly. And exactly I think that's the problem here. Well, I do now.
Well, to give you an idea why I think this and why I think the opposition are doing it so well is if you know this bit, then the rest makes sense. These bikes have too much power, right, for the tyre. And the tyres are the best things I've ever used. They're incredible. But when I got to ride them once, Misano last year on Pico's bike. And the thing is, though, it has to deliver it super smoothly in the beginning. Otherwise, you get spin, you know, when they're leaning over. And if you get that initial spin, it never recovers. All of the engineers tell me the same thing. If you make that tyre break loose, you lose the whole exit because the electronics have to cut and that to try and let the tyre get grip again, but you've already lost all the way down that exit. So the idea is to have a delivery so smooth that you don't break the traction in the beginning and then keep that drive all the way down that exit. And I think the Yamaha and the Honda are breaking that traction, you know, and basically not delivering it smooth enough. That's my gut feeling. Can I throw one other piece of the puzzle that backs up my theory is I know I'm looking for it, but how's this? So there was someone in the paddock, has nothing to do with the motorcycle racing, is about ear protection and headphones and stuff like that. And he's wandering around, obviously trying to make some beautiful products. actually, I've got someone. I'm going to take my headphones off and get the name right. What is it? Audio Technica. Yep. And so I'm a nosy bastard. So I'm wandering around looking over his shoulder, trying to see the volume. He's got a decibel meter, the volume of all the bikes, you know, and I know this is a pit lane, not out, and you know, he's getting them going past and stuff. And so from what I saw, the volume of the bikes went like this: the noisiest to quietest, okay, was Honda, then Yamaha, then KTM Aprilia, then Ducati. And so if you flip that up the other way, what do you get? You know?
Yeah, the most rideable is the quietest.
The last piece of that puzzle was, in the 90s, I rode for a few superbike manufacturers, and one of them wouldn't, I'm talking factories, one of them wouldn't pass the noise control after the race. If you got into Parc Fermé, it wouldn't pass noise control, okay? And they didn't want to put a bigger muffler on, it's heavier, it lost power. So they went, let's change the map when you come into technical control, okay? So, and what it was a more retarded ignition curve, and it made the noise way less, you know? Okay. So to make the power way less, softer, but the noise just dropped right off, so it had passed noise control. I know that's cheating, but that's what happened. And all of these things to me is more power, more noise, more aggressive delivery, more problems. So anyway, that's my take.
All right.
Okay. Well, the other thing that supports that is Mark and the boys were all riding that new Calex chassis this week, and the result was pretty much exactly the same as it was on the old chassis. Mark can still fight at the front. The rest of them are falling in the gravel, like trying to get into
10. Only Mia had it, Mia and Mark. Mia had one, Mark had two, and none of the other guys had it. They're all got their fingers crossed that this break will allow. I mean, only from my experience, what happens is they will build more for Mark, and they will try another angle. You know, we'll probably to tell the difference, but they'll do something different to see if they can improve the weakness that Mark's pointed out on the Calyx, even though it's a step forward, it has some weaknesses. So they'll make new ones, give it to Mark to try, and the spares that have already been tested by Mark, you know, will get filtered down through the other. That's normally what happens. So then we'll see, hopefully, on one and Tucker, and they'll be able to.
Now, Simon, I'm an unabashed Fabio Quartararo fan. I love him. I hang my banner out for him. It's killing me that Fabulous is not so fabulous this year. It must be torturing him as well. You know?
Yeah, you're right. It's bloody sad to see. I go to all his debriefs. If I ever miss one, I get the recording off a colleague. Listen to everything he says.
Yamaha seems to be in a worse position than Honda in many ways.
Oh, mate, just as deep in the shit. I totally agree. Look, guys.
And without the benefit of a satellite team or anything like that, you know, while we all love Cal Crutchlow, he's fast and he's a great test rider, but, you know, what happens? How do we fix this?
Well, I got to defend Carl. I think he's got the experience.
Yes.
He's still fast.
Yes.
You know, when he goes to those tests, I look at all the times and bloody hell, he's still really quick. He was in the like 38s, you know, in the heat in Jerez. And I'm like, he's still fast. He's got experience. He's ridden for different manufacturers. So the thing that I see is they don't use him enough. They're not using and listening. I said on the commentary last weekend, that I don't think it's a coincidence that the two big movers in the last couple of years are Aprilia and KTM. They're also the two big listeners, meaning they run with what their riders say. They go, oh, the rider said this. Oh, he said it as well. Let's go and make something for that, try and prove it. Where I get the impression, you know, and my impression, it comes from riding for those manufacturers way back, knowing how they work and watching them now, what they're doing about things. And that is the Japanese kind of more have a theory and they're looking for things to back it up, you know?
Yeah, and they're more monolithic in their approach, you know. This is, you know, we know, we're Honda, we're Yamaha, we know this shit, we got this shit.
Yeah. Well, I'd definitely say that about Honda, yeah. So so the thing I'm hoping for both Yamaha and Honda is they can do what is proven to work and steal some knowledge, some people with knowledge, because that's what KTM have just done. I mean, Gigi came from Aprilia, you know. He was poached from Aprilia. And he's organized everything more than replaced people. He's just organized to get the best out of what they had, you know. Then you look at what KTM have done recently, like there's a bunch of Ducati faces in there, and they've come with knowledge, and that's including Jack's crew, Jack himself, and engineers, Fabiano, you know, the top engineer. He came from Ducati. He was like alongside Gigi for years. Yamaha and Honda need to do the same, especially when it comes to aero. You know, I mean, well, I think the Italians are leading in aero and electronics, power delivery. They need to steal someone to tell them how to do that.
Would it be fair to say that post Casey Stoner, Ducati entered a very dark period in their development, and their approach seemed to be we're just going to put more bikes out there and get more information. There are 8 Ducatis out there now. No other manufacturer is anywhere near that. Yamaha has just, you know, is running without a satellite team this year. Aprilia's now got a satellite team. Is a satellite team crucial?
It helps, as in you see that if Ducati is struggling somewhere, they've got 8 guys info, you know, over one session to come back to the factory. And one of them, the chance of one of them finding an answer to it is much higher than 2, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Finding the answer. So that is part of it. But also you can see they can use, for example, the Pramac guys to try new parts and have it filter through rather than the factory guys themselves having to carry all the load. So, I mean, everyone knows, you're dead right. It's super important. But, I mean, how long can Lucio hang on? Ciccanello, you know, keep his sponsors. That's what really worries me. Because I don't want to lose the Japanese manufacturer.
No, and Lucci, he's been an important part of that paddock for a long time. While we're on the subject of Yamaha, we've had a lot of conversations this year about Frankie Morbidelli. It's been a couple of dismal years for him, and everybody got a little bit excited in Argentina with a couple of fourth places.
I love Frankie.
We adore him. Yeah, we adore him. And the place would be a lot sadder without him. But Argentina kind of turned things around a bit, but the conditions suited Frankie there, and they're not going to suit him anywhere else unless we get bad weather again. And even then, he's not amazing in the rain. It's just Argentina's a special kind of place that works for him. But what do you see for Frankie's future? Can he hold on there, or does Yamaha have to make a call?
The thing is, if you were straight up, Fabio has just been doing something amazing the last couple of years and making the bike look better than it is. And now he's kind of recently lost that magic for whatever reason. You know, he's obviously lost the feeling to be able to do something incredible like he was doing. And now he's not far ahead of Frankie, which is pretty much where the bike is. And to be fair, I think Frankie is not helped by the poor bugger's broken, meaning going through 2 years of looking like shit next to Fabio. It's so down. But if you put Frankie on the Ducati, for example, and give him by the end of the season or mid-season, I bet he's right with the other Ducati guys, you know? He's a good rider. It's just that, you know, his confidence is heading south. Yeah, and I really feel for him. It'd be like being Mark's teammate, wouldn't it? You know?
Yeah. There's a few haven't survived that.
Yeah.
I just realised I didn't answer the question about Fabio. I'm sorry, Boris.
No,
you're right. Answered that properly, because we've kind of answered it on Frankie, I think, as simple as that.
Yep.
Give him a great package and get his confidence back. He's one of the good riders, you know. And he's probably not Fabio or Mark, but if you give him but nobody else is either, you know.
No, that's right.
Maybe Binder. Oh my God, what he pulls out of his bike every weekend. But just to answer your question on Fabio before I forget, is I've seen him do magic for the last couple of years and been so supportive of him because he's just been amazing, you know.
He's a pleasure to watch. And the other thing I love so much about Fabio is when things are good, he is just a joy to behold. You know what I mean?
And he just squeezes that bit more. You know?
Yeah. Amazing. Well, that's
entry in there, which is where I think he's lost a bit of feel. Entry and turn, you know.
Sure. Well, you're an ex-racer, right? So you know probably certainly far more than I do about it. I've never, you know, my racing career lasted all of 2/3 of a lap. But that whole head thing, you know, if you're in a good space and you're confidence, you just do greater and greater things.
Yeah, that's bang on. That's pretty much what I was saying about Frankie. Well, it's head the wrong way, you know. You're dead right. Fabio,
because I think because I have, when you're racing, the processing of information happens almost on a subconscious level. It has to, because there's so much input being fed into you.
Yeah, bang on.
With all that stuff that you're kind of on autopilot, but you're not at the same time. I'm just trying to articulate something I've never done. I mean, I've ridden quickly in situations, and this is what I see, is that you're on autopilot and you're laser focused on what's happening and you're hypersensitive to everything that's going on all at once, and yet there's a sense of calmness about it. You know what I mean? There's almost a zen.
Well, it's like, you're dead right. The feeling is like trusting your subconscious, because you – I always after experimenting with it, is if the front tire is telling you it's going to let go, but – there's nothing physical you can feel that you know you can feel.
It's like a spider sense.
It's telling you. It's telling you that if you push it anymore, it's going to let go. So many a time I went, yeah, but I haven't felt anything. Let's just push it some more, and it lets go.
And then gravel.
So basically, yeah, exactly. So it's like you're riding around listening to subconscious information. You don't even know where it's coming from, unless it's obvious things, you know. But yeah, you did right. Hey, I've got to answer this about Fabio before I forget. It's sick, then my mind will be more free. It's Fabio is he's such a natural, and I don't believe, this is only my opinion, he, you know, someone working with him could tell me different, but I don't believe he's a test rider. You know, he hasn't got experience different manufacturers, hasn't got experience with different things, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Apart from them mucking around with the Yamaha. And sometimes it takes, for example, Jack, you know, that to know, you know, this is only one example, to know how to steer them on that engine firing order with the KTM. All the, you know, riders will say, hey, it doesn't feel any faster. And apparently Jack went, yeah, but it's easier. So we'll be able to get more out of it, you know what I mean?
And therefore it's faster.
And yeah, and I think a young super talent, natural ability, is not going to do that. He needs help, you know, needs the test rider to point out and show. Then he will get you the results. But what I'm thinking, the other thing is watching him, Fabio struggling big style. He wears his heart on his sleeve. He's bagged Yamaha a little bit too much, you know, because the reason I say that, fans won't agree with me because they'll love Fabio and that, but Fabio is compensated very, very well to be the ambassador for Yamaha. You can't repeatedly, every debrief, give Yamaha a kick in the bollocks. You can't. You can say, I mean, you could, like Brad, Brad Binder's been through a couple of years of it, but he never bagged them. He said, well, you know, if he's asked where the weakness is, he'll say, yeah, here and here, we need to improve there, which is fine, you know. But what I'm saying is Fabio looks like he's taking it so hard.
He looks emotional.
He hasn't been through the shit times on a shit bike.
Yes.
He has, but he's survived it with his brilliance.
I picked that up in your commentary on the weekend, that you said that this will either make him or break him. This forges riders.
Yeah, I didn't say make or break.
Well, no, you didn't say that. You said it forges.
It forges them. Yeah, basically the shit times make you stronger. If you survive them, it makes you better, you know, and you can handle the things that are thrown at you. Anyway, enough about that. But let's hope Yamaha can sort their aero out, because that's a big part of the wheelie and the turning that I think is missing. And hope they sort their power delivery out, their electronics, everything that can help make their machine make a step forward and make Frankie and Fabio look good.
Can we just touch on the front tyre for a minute? So there was a lot made of it this year. So with the minimum tyre pressures coming into play.
We're getting a lot of questions about tyre pressures.
Yeah.
You wanted to talk about that too.
And there was concerns, particularly from Fabio. He was someone that was worried about the front tyre issues. He's the Yamaha sensitive to it apparently. But what are you hearing? Because there's not been a lot coming out about the performance of the front tyre. There's a lot of front-end crashes on the weekend, although that's not that unusual for Le Mans. But it's been happening all year. And one of the things I've noticed is some of these front-end crashes are happening very early in the corner. They're under brakes before the guys are even really tipping in. The front's letting go. What are you hearing?
Yeah, that's a great question because I have recently had racers from my day contact me and say, basically, they struggle to believe it, you know, about this tire temp thing. And so I'm going to go through, I'll explain all the stuff I know. And so I'd like to convince you that it is real.
we believe you.
No. I know you do, but I'm talking to the people that don't. that don't believe it's real. So first of all, Le Mans, Boris was right when he said that was Le Mans, those crashes. It wasn't the tire temp problem like we had at Jerez in the heat or the other hot races. So Le Mans, the problem there is the front tire is symmetric, you know, same rubber left and right, but it's all right-hand corners with a couple of lefts and with long gaps between. So you choose the tire, for example, the soft, and all those right-handers overwork it and it starts moving around too much. It's going to drop off towards the end of the race. But the left is safe because the rubber's soft enough to stay, warm or, say, give traction, even though it hasn't been used much on the left. Then you move to the medium or the hard and, woohoo, the right is way better. You can push it, you can go faster, you can brake harder, whatever, and it'll put up with it. Okay, the harder compounds don't have the same amount of grip on full lean, but they work good on the right, and then you turn left and crash because the thing hasn't got any grip with that amount of temperature because it hasn't been used much. So that was the Le Mans crashes, you know, people trying to use the harder ones or wrecking the right on the softer ones, you know. But just to answer about the tyre temp, which will happen again. It happened at Jerez. It'll happen again. There'll be lots upcoming in the hot temperatures. So the front tyre temp, this is what I said to this guy that struggled to believe it, you know, and he's a good racer, you know. I'm talking top three in the world championship a few times. So, like, you're talking just if you think in front of you is a bike – or you can watch them come in, like with 700-degree exhausts when they come off track. And everything's so compact and behind that fairing and that, they start catching on fire when they stop. I mean, everyone's seen it. They spray it with water, the carbon fiber fairings where it's close to the exhaust. They spray it with the electric leaf blowers to get air, the exhaust to cool down. These bikes, if you were going flat out and pulled up at the lights, they'd burst into flames.
Yeah, they're fucking nuclear reactors. That's what they are.
Yeah. And then, you know, on the hot races, I've heard an engineer tell me that they got up to 145-degree oil temp, in the engine. They're all aluminium, you know, that engine – The chassis, everything's aluminium bolted together. Okay, not the KTM chassis, but you know what I'm saying.
So much aluminium
around there that the whole thing's conducting, which aluminium does so well. The whole bike is glowing, you know. The whole bike is super hot. And then the massive problem, I've done a tech talk on this, is keeping the fuel from boiling, because the fuel boils at around 65 degrees, depending on how dense the fuel is, because they use different fuels for different tracks, you know. They use a more dense one, has less power, you know, but it has less flammable stuff in it, but it can go the distance, you know, because they can use less of it. So depending on the density of the fuel, it boils around 65 degrees. Boiling means bubbles. Then the fuel pump doesn't pick up the fuel, cavitates, and the engine stops. Huge problem early days in MotoGP. That's why bikes were stopping more often than bikes blowing up, you know. And so they have to insulate the fuel tank, but also duct air. They say it's an air cushion around the fuel tank to keep it at a lower temperature than the bike, you know. And so then you've got carbon brakes next to the front wheel and tyre that get up to like 850 degrees. Yep. And that's radiating heat onto the front rim, so heating the air in it, you know, heating the rim and heating the air in it. And they say that one bike in front of you is okay, but, you know, they can have, that's one thing. But then two bikes in front or three bikes in front, each one is heating that air at a higher temp. By the time it gets to the guy third or fourth back, it's crazy. To give you an idea, then at Sachsenring last year, it was 30-something degrees, mid-30s, I think.
That's right, it was hot.
Then a couple of guys at the back of the grid, I was talking to them, you know, when I, not back of the grid, but like one of them got a bad start. One was, that was his position. He was riding around after all these bikes. He said the first two laps, his look on his face, he said it was unbearable. He said, the neck, the skin on your neck, he said it was burning. Yeah. I was so hot that I was thinking of pulling in. It was like, it went through my mind. He said, but then as it spread out, it got less bad and then we're away. But another manufacturer told me they registered 84 degrees air temp coming in to the airbox, you know?
What you're saying is absolutely crucial to the understanding of what's going on, because a lot of people would never have been up close to a race bike. You either watch it on TV or watch it on the side of the track, and you can't feel the heat. You get on, they're kind of hot. They're not hot, they are on fire. They're just not.
Yeah. It's only the wind.
Yeah, it's only wind.
Which is burning the guy behind, but yeah. It's only the wind taking away that stops them bursting into flames. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's what people need to understand. So when sort of Fabio says, if I get behind a bike, that bike heats my front tire, you know, someone who doesn't understand what's going to go, oh, fuck off. That's not what's happening at all. You're just being shit. No, motherfucker, yeah. The motorcycle in front is melting my front tire. And that's why I need to get clean air.
Yeah, bang on. So the normal running front temperature of front tire is something like 70, 75 degrees. At Jerez, riders were talking more 104.
Jesus.
And if you guess the tire temperature, you know, like tire pressure, right, meaning you run it super low so you can get it up to 104 without it going too high in pressure. It's still the right pressure, right? Mm. So you run a low pressure, so it'll come up when it's 100 degrees to still manageable. When I say manageable, if you didn't do that, if you run a normal pressure, it gets up to 100 degrees, you've got such a high pressure, you know, like you're talking 2 bar or something or more, then the contact patch is so small that they lock up the front tire in a straight line and you've got no grip. You crash on the side. And then even if you get the pressure right, at 104 degrees, the rubber is so moving around on the carcass, you know, so the tire's not working the same. So the thing I want to finish with is how they're trying to handle it. I've seen like front wheels, we've all seen the front colours change, you know, they run silver or white, and that's to try and reflect the radiating heat from those front brakes, you know, to try and handle it. But the other thing I've seen is volume of the front wheel get bigger, you know, they bulge up, and so the air volume in that front wheel is bigger than normal. And I thought, yeah, but more volume, if you heat it to the same temperature, then you're going to have more increase,
it will take longer to heat. An engineer
pointed out to me when I said that, he said, yeah, but you're talking about the same amount of energy into a bigger volume, you know, so then it makes sense, you get a less change. So they're doing that. But basically, to answer that guy's, you know, the ex-racer who I respect a lot that was talking to me about it, answer his question, yeah, we had the same problem, but in the 90s, the bikes had half the – you're talking superbikes, four strokes. Yep. The 90s four strokes had half the power. They made roughly half the heat coming off them. And, yeah, we had it at the hot races and behind a group, you would occasionally, you know, feel the front tire, what the hell, and then crash. But we didn't have sensors, so we didn't know what the tire temperature was. and the technical term for it back then from the team was wanker when you fell off. You know, that was it. We didn't know why you fell off.
Yeah, shut up, dickhead. Right? You're riding it wrong.
And so
sorry to fucking talk too much.
No,
that's all right. So Michelin's, you know, enforcing this year this minimum pressure for the front. So what's their theory? I've had a lot of people say to me, why would they do that? Why wouldn't they let the guys run a lower pressure if they want? And clearly Michelin must think it's a safety issue. Is that the reasoning?
That is the whole thing, yeah. I mean, they're not enforcing it. It was meant to be enforced from Jerez.
Oh, they haven't done it.
And I heard a couple of good arguments from riders saying, well, Frankie Morbidelli was one saying, like, come on, guys, you don't change the rules in the football World Cup part of the way through.
Yeah, absolutely.
You start and finish with the same, which was a pretty good argument. But Everyone agreed on this, that it was, you know, going to be. But when it came time, apparently, this is secondhand, I have nothing to substantiate it, but apparently the teams went, we can't let you do this. It can't, it's not manageable. For the reason I told you, if they run the legal pressure at the beginning of the race and they're behind a group, it will make their rider crash.
So, enforcing the rule is dangerous. So it's, like, it's almost like they wanted the minimum pressure in order to make it safer, but if they enforced it, more guys crash.
Yeah, safer for the tire manufacturer, as in imagine a tire flying apart.
That's
you run it too soft, you damage the car because the rubber can come off. We've seen it before. With the rear tires, but we're talking about front tires. We've seen front tires delaminate, whatever, but. The thing is, how's this for an example? I got told Malaysia last year, I've kind of given away now who it was, but a guy starts the race with the correct pressure because the team knew he'd be in a group, okay? And so they set the pressure to run in that group. And so they have to set it low. So he goes in the race, but he gets a long lap penalty. Okay, I think he had it before the race. He rides through the long lap, comes out, and he's not in the group anymore. He's alone. The front tire temperature drops, so pressure drops to below the legal limit. So if they'd enforced it, he'd have got disqualified. This is the thing. The teams have to guess where they're going to be in the race, in a group or not. And if they get it wrong, the rider either crashes or they get disqualified if the rules are enforced. So they couldn't.
Just on this whole rules thing, I just want to move away from the tyre thing, which I think you've explained brilliantly well. I read that at Le Mans, the riders were going to have a discussion with Freddie Spencer and the boys from Race Control about the perhaps inconsistency of applying penalties and stuff like that. And at Le Mans, there seemed to be like the normal, you know, the normal penalties, they weren't any weird. There wasn't any weird shit going on. You know, Bezech got, you know, drop a place penalty for what he did, and Alex Marquez got his 3 grid place penalty. Did they have that? Was that meeting a thing that happened?
Yes, Friday. I obviously wasn't there. Yeah,
tell me. Yeah. Clearly, that was before the race, and it seemed to have some effect. So. I'm so glad that they have because, you know, from my perspective, you know, Freddie and the boys were all on the bong, you know, because it was crazy what they were doing.
Yeah, I agree that the race was handled really well, wasn't it? Like,
spot on.
The only one that bummed me out was the Binder having, you know, it looked like he'd lost enough.
Yeah.
But that is not a decision by the stewards. That is a rule done technically by the technical guys. It doesn't even have to go to the stewards. And you cut it, it pops up on the screen because they cut it. And then you have to lose a certain amount in that sector compared to your average time through that sector.
Yep.
And Brad didn't know that rule. He said, shit, I thought it was my fault. I thought I just had to lose a certain amount on the rider in front. I gauged it on that, but it was actually, you know, the other way. And that was the only bummer because I think when it comes to it kind of damaged the race because he would have been in the final.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm kind of going, he's lost enough. But that's not the steward's fault at all. All the decisions are pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the weekend during the race. So, the meeting, I listened to all the riders' debriefs. They were all there. There was mixed reactions. I would say the majority thought, hey, this is good. We should do this more often, talk, communicate, and we'll have less problems, you know?
Yep.
Because there was a couple that just went, I'm not going to comment. Oh, I mean, for example, Aleix said he refused to comment, but he obviously wasn't impressed. He was like, it's almost like he's given up. He's just going to go about his own thing and see what happens, you know? Then the real whinger on the weekend was Luca Marini, you know, like he
carried on like a little bitch.
Well,
seriously,
I was disappointed because I like Luca.
Yeah.
I was like, come on. And Brad Binder, he accused Brad of hitting him.
Yeah,
you know?
It was bullshit.
Brad's, that's the exact words Brad used, you know. So
And look, here's the video of me not hitting you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But Luca was basically saying you're not consistent. You said you would be if there was any contact. But anyway, the thing is, you know what I think the whole problem is this world we live in, and everyone wants penalties. You know, someone to pay for something naughty they did. And
yes.
It's not going to work in our sport. It's not going to work. And the thing is, it's motorbike racing, and there is going to be some contact. And like I said at Jerez, and I know how difficult the job is for the stewards. I can imagine, you know, it'd be like being a headmaster and nobody's trying to agree on what you say, and everybody is.
You've got a whole class of dysfunctional ADD lunatics that want to kill each other most of the time. They're perfectly nice off the track. On the track, they're all murderers.
And I think the only way that it's going to work, and is what I saw on the weekend, a step in that direction, is that let them go racing and just jump hard on the dumb shit. That is clear. Everyone can see it needs a penalty. And the only other one, you can't just leave it at that, I don't believe, because I know what it's like to have some guy out there that doesn't quite get a penalty every week, but he causes shit every week. He ruins someone's race every week. Jump on that after a certain number that he causes, you know. Yep. Say, look, it's not a penalty normally, but you've done two others. So that's a penalty, you know. You can have your a perfect example, 3 grid plates. Yeah. You know, Alex Marquez.
Yeah, he's a serial offender.
Well, as much as I'm a fan, and I think he's even going to win one in the future, he's a serial offender. So you've got to let everyone know that you are watching. Yeah. But apart from that, let's hope that what we saw on the weekend is the new norm.
Yeah. Hey, listen, last time we spoke to you, it was pre-season, and we had a bit of a discussion about the sprint races, because at that stage, nobody knew what was in store. And there was a lot of people in the sport who were critics, and some are still trying to stick by that. but we actually, in the podcast we just recorded earlier, we just talked about the number of DNFs that we've seen so far this year, and it was something like 29 DNFs in Grand Prix races and 17 in the sprints. So it hasn't been, with the exception of the first one, it hasn't been the carnage that people expected. And we kind of discussed it and said, look, the first two laps of any race are potentially carnage, and once the boys settle themselves down and sort themselves out, and the race is still a dozen laps, there's still a bit of time there, you know. So they're not being as frantic as I think some people were scared they would be. What's your take on the sprint races as a spectacle and how they've worked out? Do you think it's a win?
I have been watching really close, and really close to the stuff you've been you're just mentioning there, because I wanted to know if it was more dangerous for the boys if the sprint, you know. And pretty much every Sunday, the GP is just as crazy,
absolutely,
as the sprint, if not more so on the weekend.
Absolutely.
You know?
Like, so, do you remember? Sorry, just to interrupt you. Remember that Moto3 race? They turned it into a 5-lap sprint.
Oh, Texas last year.
There was a Moto3 race where they turned, and that's a pure sprint race. It's 5 laps, 12 laps. Yeah, they call it a sprint race, but it's kind of not. It's not, you know, proper GP race, but.
Your average club day's 5 lap
your
races.
Average club, for a reason, right? But, you know, 5 laps is a fucking sprint. Fuck off, you know. We're going to go balls out for 5 laps, you know. We've got, you know, a handful of petrol in there. Let's go. But, you know, it's. I think it's great. I think Dorna has just nailed this. It's fantastic.
Well, like when it first came along, I don't know if you remember, I was like really worried. I was like,
you were concerned for the safety.
Double the pressure on the boys over the weekend, which are, look, we don't want any more. Like, there's been some leave our sport from too much pressure, you know, and it's on the limit anyway. And if you put more on, you're going to get some fold, and I don't want to see more of them, you know. And like, you can only handle so much pressure. Each human handles different. And I was like, oh, they're not going to get paid more. They're going to have more risk. You know, I was worried. Then they didn't give us any warning, remember? It wasn't
They just sprung it on you.
wasn't done very well. So that was my initial thought. And then I stood back and went, what are they trying to achieve? And I think they're achieving it, you know, absolutely. More viewers.
Absolutely.
And the thing is, if the way I look at it, because I'm for the riders first,
yes,
is if they grow our sport in the right direction, the riders and everyone else in the paddock will benefit, meaning our wages will go up. You know, we can have more, like more money, better flights, more, you know, better accommodation. Everything will improve if they, and so then I started going, okay, let's hope it works. And it isn't, the last piece of the puzzle for me was, is it more dangerous than the GP? And it isn't.
No.
It hasn't been.
No.
So the GP, the crash, the whole thing on the crashes is, one of the riders put it perfectly. I was already thinking this and he said it. And I think it was either Pico or Alex Marquez, one of them. And they basically said that years ago, the sport wasn't so close. Now, everyone's on a competitive machine. There's not the fact the haves and have-nots, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone's on a machine that arguably, you know, can win the race, meaning they're all on factory bikes. It's not like privateer junkers.
Yeah,
like
there are no backmarkers anymore.
Yeah,
do you remember? Exactly. Do you remember the role backmarkers used to play? You know, the guys are getting lapped.
Yeah, those guys are getting lapped.
And you know, we're six laps from the end, and you know, Dylan's coming up on some backmarks. Think, oh shit, it's going to get funky now, right? And sometimes it didn't.
I mean, riders point out you can be on the podium one weekend and 12th the next.
Yeah,
you know, 15th the next. So it's that competitive, and I think when you get all of those good machines and good riders so close and funnel them through turn two at Jerez, you're going to have some crashes, you know? And it wasn't that the riders were doing dumb shit. It was that you're all trying to put them on the same line. They're all trying to make up. And also, the big thing is they're all trying to fight for the spot ahead to get that cool air on their front tire. They don't want to be behind a group of riders, you know. And you're going to see crashes, whether it's the sprint or the race. But what do you want to do? What can we do? If we want close racing, which we all want, we're going to see more falls, you know.
But that's the sport. There is a huge inherent risk in it, and it only highlights how talented these guys are that not all of them are crashing all the time. You know, they're really, really good at this.
If I said falls, you're going to see more contacts.
Yeah.
You know, that's the key
fine.
You're going to see more. Anyway, it's not dumb shit or repeated offences, I think. Otherwise, let's go racing.
To me, just to go back to Le Mans this weekend, the outstanding performance for me, I mean, maybe he wouldn't have been there if there hadn't been so many DNFs, but, you know, the rookie.
Fernandez
2.0. How good
Augusta,
was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, Augusta. How good was that ride? Zarco pulled him along and pulled him along and pulled him along. For a rookie to ride such a mature race in you know, the crash palace that is Le Mans, and come forth, bravo.
Like I said in after the flag show, Augusto, take a bow.
Yep.
Like, fantastic. He was fast all weekend, and he didn't – there was some guys fall off, you know, like a good – the two contacts, you know, so you saw multiple guys ahead fall off. But it wasn't like he was half a lap down. He was there stalking them, putting pressure on, waiting to pick it up, and – even fought Alesh on the last lap and finished ahead of Alesh.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, he beat the captain.
Captain Karen, I know you're saying your nickname. You know, the team love him. I've heard this all season because I ask. You know, I know some of his mechanics and that. They love him. He listens. He's really professional. Also at the debriefs, he's super professional always. And super hungry, and they say clever. He learns. They tell him something. They go, look, you're good here and here, but you're losing here because of this. He'll go out and do it, you know. And so, yeah, the guy is. Hey, this it only backs up my thoughts on Bez. You know,
yep.
Bez is great. I love him on all angles.
He is just the sweetest guy to see. Like when you interviewed him after the race. He's just – he appears to be such a
– smile.
Yeah, real smile, a gentle, genuine soul, you know what I mean? As opposed to someone of the intensity of, say, Jorge Martin, who is hyper-intense. You know, he's just on. Bezech looks like he's just cruising, right? He's the dude.
Bezech is his own man as well. He says what he thinks always. Yep. You know, especially if you poke him a little bit, he'll give you the answer straight. Like, but he's been so good since he arrived here. Like, and I think that it's hard to tell who's going to do that from Moto2. But the exciting thing for me is there's more guys here. That, like, we've seen Bez now, Augusto. There is more to come from Moto2 that are going to shake up our sport, you know, in the next few years. I'm really excited about it because that class we're talking about is only going to get stronger.
Yeah, totally. But VR, sorry, Doug, I was going to say that the whole VR46 team, the Mooney team, seems to have, like, really, really brought their A game this year. I mean, apart from Luca being a bitch this time around, he's usually really quick. And, you know, Bezech is Bezech. Always rated him. But VR46 is just – it's kicking ass and taking names.
You've got to remember as well the difference, I think, between Bez and on his first year and now, you know, against – Augusto, is that he's riding a bike last year and this year that was proven the year before, you know, by the factory Ducati guys, and they've got data on, you know, from on that bike at that circuit at everywhere they go, and Augusto's riding a bike that's new and that isn't proven. The factory boys are trying to, you know, fine tune it each weekend for that circuit, and Augusto's having to do the same, so it's not easy. You see what I mean? If you compare the jobs. Next year it'll be better for the KTM riders because this is their first real strong bike that will get passed on, you know. But all I'm saying is that, you know, Bez, the cool thing about being on the Duke right now is if you do your job, we see the result, you know, and Bez is doing the job.
Hey, listen, one last thing before we let you go and get on with your day. We were just recording our podcast, our special one for our Patreon Pit Crew guys, and we had half a dozen questions about that relate to Pedro Acosta, 2024, Marc Marquez. So there's, you see bits and pieces, rumours flying around about Marquez potentially trying to get out of his Honda contract and go to KTM. Obviously, KTM's got an issue because they've been grooming Pedro to come up to MotoGP at some point. They've now got Jack and Brad locked into contracts for next year. There's rumours around about a potential Husqvarna team, which would be another pseudo-KTM team. KTM sort of saying they'd like Pedro to do another year in Moto2. I don't know that Pedro's going to be happy about that. How do you see all of this playing out? Do you think KTM could throw in a Husqvarna team and find a home for Pedro? Do they put him in the Gas team and lose someone from there? Is Marquez going to see out his Honda contract? I can't imagine Honda letting him go. They'd make him stay home and do nothing for 2024 rather than let him ride somewhere else. But how do you see all this playing out? Because there's not a lot of seats available next year. There's only a couple of seats going to come up. There's Frankie's seat potentially if Frankie doesn't get renewed. And other than that, where does Pedro go?
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know more than you. Tug, I've got
you're no fucking help.
Listeners. No. But what I totally agree. I'm not all I can do is put it in perspective, you know. Hey, for the viewers that don't realise what your name is, Tug, it's Tug McClutchin, right?
Yeah.
Tug McClutchin?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Tug as in pull my clutch in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was quite good. So I just wanted to make sure that this is you. I thought it was good.
There was a very good reason for me not using a real name when we started this.
Yeah. Hey, but you know your stuff, mate, and I don't know who feeds you. Some people think it's me, and it isn't.
No,
I don't know.
No, it's not you.
We've never spoken on the phone or messaged or anything, and I don't know who you are real life. So it's not me, listeners. I don't know who's feeding Tuck all this awesome info.
Well, it's not me, brother. I'm just the tattooed lunatic that runs around yelling at people.
Sometimes that's me too.
By the way, Tug, I loved your take on the journos the other week. I feel exactly the same as you.
I've copped a bit of hate for that.
Positive. We needed an injection of positive journos, and the bitter old ones can piss off. And we, you know, because our sport is great. you know, do something positive for it every week instead of trying to pick holes in it.
Bitches love the sport. That's it. Love the sport.
Well, let Dorna know I'm available if they want me to travel the world again and, you know, come work for them and pump out content. I'm happy to do it.
Exactly. Anyway, let's get on to your answer. I heard the same rumor as you. And look, I don't know what's going on, but there is two spots for another manufacturer. KTM can do that, make it look like another manufacturer, come in completely separate with Huskies. They could do that. And I'm sure Dorna would like it. The other thing that backs it up is that when a manufacturer goes well, we've seen teams want it. So we've seen it with Ducati. Teams want them. And now you can feel teams and riders want to ride the KTM, you know, whatever it is, KTM Gas or in Husky, whatever they want. Then you get things like Pedro saying nice things about KTM, which I'm sure he wouldn't have a year ago, you know, out loud to the press, KTM have done so much for me, you know. That's the sort of thing rider says when he wants to ride your bike. And I'm not bagging Pedro. It's all riders, you know. And look, it makes sense because there is no spots. KTM have a logjam of talent, you know.
Yeah.
I imagine if Red Bull have the funds and want it to happen, Mark is the Red Bull rider. Pedro, same, man, unreal. What a team that would be. The only thing, what a team. I mean, the only thing is the things that feedback I got from the KTM guys when I've broached this in the past, you know, this is a while ago, is that with Mark, all superstars, they're as big as the sport, you know, like Mark is that if he wins on the bike, it's Mark. If he loses on the bike, your bike is shit because not even Mark can make it win, you know? And so it's kind of, I would imagine it's someone like Red Bull that would force it to happen, make it happen, and KTM go, all right, you know. But look, I know no more than you. I kind of hope it does happen because this sounds really exciting. But at the same time, I don't want to lose the Japanese manufacturers just because they're having a low, you know. Yeah. They came in and pushed the Europeans out 40 years ago. I don't want the
It's a pendulum. It's a pendulum. The sport's a pendulum. They swing and backwards and forwards.
Yeah. Okay. I was saying, you know, no, I know I'm getting off track here, but it's saying that when Honda first started getting their ass handed to them, I loved it because I like seeing a bit, you know, the big guy get his ass kicked, especially when he's a bit arrogant. Sure. When he's a bit arrogant, and then now, and recent years, I've no, I don't want it. That's enough. I want them to be competitive and fight back. I genuinely do.
Simon, that's the beauty of the sport. It moves you emotionally. We're emotionally invested in the brands, in the riders. And I mean, that's why one of the reasons I love it so very much is I genuinely burn for this, you know? It moves me on an emotional level. And I don't, you know, fuck Honda and all that shit, but Jesus, come on, guys, do something, you know, and you're on this emotional roller coaster watching them try and watching, you know, Aprilia suddenly come to the fore, KTM suddenly come to the fore when, you know, 3 years ago KTM was just, oh, you're kidding me, right? Why are you guys even here? That's the glory of this sport.
Yeah, and why we love it, mate, and not just because I work for Dorna. Wherever I go in the future, I'll be exactly the same.
Yeah, we are what we are.
I care about the riders. I hate seeing the Honda riders suffering at the moment, and it's enough. Honda have had enough humiliation. I want them to be back where they belong, you know, the giants. Hey, and Tug, I reckon they can. They can turn it around in another year. You know, they've got Ken on their side. They must understand where their problems are now. Mm. You know, so let's hope they can turn up. Hopefully we'll see it Misano. I've asked my bosses, please send me to Misano test because I'll be down there with a recording for you to play and compare it to the other Honda engines, because I'm sure if I believe it's that, I'm sure they do too, you know, that yeah, sure. their problems come there. Oh, look, so let's see in Mizano if we can hear a different sounding Honda or something, you know.
Simon, we just got a message from Fredo. Fredo, you can't see, but Fredo's not with us tonight because he's out doing big business. He just sent me a message. He said, "You guys, have you got Simon on?" I went, "Yes, we do." He said, "Tell him I love him. Full homo."
Oh. Fantastic. Boys, you're bloody great.
Enough of that.
Not just because you're funny and you swear, and but also because you're sharp as tacks. You really do know what's going on. It's great.
That you're talking about tugs. I'm kind of like a butter knife, but or a mallet.
Hey, we didn't talk before we go. We didn't talk about Pecco versus Vinales.
I said in our podcast, which you'll hear tomorrow, I kind of said, look, racing incident, but if anything, if you want to point a finger at someone, I'd probably point it at Mav a little bit. He probably could have turned in a little bit earlier. But
no!
Isn't it funny that we always look back and watch it again on the Monday?
Yeah.
And I'm the opposite as you on this, Tuck. If you had to point the finger a little bit, like slightly
Pecco.
I would go Pecco because... Yeah. If you pass someone on the outside, it's always a risk. I tell the track day guys for 15 years, if you're coming up on someone, don't pass them on the outside. Always pass on the inside. And if you put your bike, say you're braking in a straight line, you know, for a left-hand corner, and you put your front wheel even beside his back wheel ahead of you, he's allowed to go right to open his corner up all the way to the paint, push you on the grass, and you ain't stopping, you know? What I'm saying is Mav was ahead. Yeah, he pulled right a bit, and that's why I'm kind of going, you know, Jorge didn't do that when he
Just before that happened, Mav, it was like a switch went off in his head. And off he went. And I thought, get the fuck, look at this. It's Top Gun, real deal. And, oh, shit, he's fucking taken back Naira. Oh,
we got robbed.
We got robbed. Absolutely.
The two guys I think could take it to Bez, the only two
that I think
could hunt them down. I mean, Jorge would have been able to if he was in that spot and not eight places. Whatever it was at that stage. But the only two guys left that could take it to Bears got taken out in that crash. And Mav, for the first time, sorry, Mav, but I've given him a bit of shit lately because he's so good. The bike is there. Just get hungry, get angry, do it like you're paid to. And he did.
He did.
He was wonderful.
He
was aiming at the win, wasn't he?
Yes. Unreal. He just went off, and I thought he's sending it. Oh, he sent it a bit too much.
Right? So let's get to the most important part of that incident, and that's what happened in the gravel trap. So they carried on like a couple of soccer players, but I've had a couple of people message me and go, "Oh, that wasn't acceptable. It's not a good look for the sport." Fuck. And here in Australia, us boys are buddies with Wayne Maxwell. We love Wayne, and one of the reasons we love Wayne is he got a Moto2 wild card at Phillip Island 10 years ago, probably, and paid a lot of money for it. And someone took him out in the second corner. And in the gravel trap, this other guy had lost his visor in the crash. And Wayne managed to plant one on his nose through his helmet. And at the time, there was a whole lot of Australians go, "Oh, that's it. He's fucked his career. He's never going to get another chance." And when you talk to Wayne and say, "Fucking, what do you make of that?" He's gone, "Well, I was never going to get another fucking chance anyway. That was my chance, and this cunt ruined it. That's why I snotted him." And I kind of love Wayne for that. And what the boys did in the gravel, there's a bit of passion, I think. That's what fans want to see, you know. And then they shared it. We were kind of talking about they shared the scooter home on the way, and I reckon Mav was on the back. I reckon he was giving Pecco a bit of a reach around and whispering in his ear saying, "Next time I'm going to fucking do you, cunt." And then they get back to the pits and the camera's on them and they go, "Oh, we better shake hands."
Look, when you're so invested in it, that when you crash, especially if it's someone else, you think someone else has hit you, you're so invested that you can't believe it. You can't believe it. And I don't think you're thinking straight for that first 30 seconds, you know?
No, you're not. You've got your race face on.
You actually refuse to believe it. You go, no, 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 I'm there. I'm right there, you know. You take a little bit to come down to the reality of what's happened. And if someone's just stolen it off you in your mind, in the way you see it. My personal opinion is we at this day and age, we're not allowed to punch each other, you know. And there's nothing to do about that. That's the world now. And, I mean, whether I like that or not, it doesn't matter. That's what the world we live in.
Sure.
But I go on rugby. You're allowed to grab his shirt and shove him around and swear in his face as long as the cameras can't tell what you're saying. Like, and that's it. I mean, let them let it out because it's the truth,
yep.
You know. And as long as they're only pushing and shoving, it's absolutely fine to me.
Yeah.
But you're not allowed to punch each other because
that's yeah, no, and like, I get that. That's all about the sport. But you know,
that's what I reckon.
You've got to understand, obviously, you know this more than anyone as a professional racer, is that you're in the headspace of I'm racing, and that's where my head is. And when you say, I've got to come back, it takes about 30 seconds to go, oh, I'm not racing anymore. But I'm at the moment, yeah. I'm going to, the red mist is there. I'm going to gouge his eyes out and, you know, skull fuck him, right?
Yeah. I mean, is like road rage on steroids.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, like that. Like
absolutely. That. I mean, you guys are made of fucking adrenaline, you know, and you can't just shut that off, you know, like it's not a tap.
Exactly.
So, yeah, exactly. All right. So before we wind up, brother, I hear you've got the books, which is great. I sent you my books. You need to read them. Good. They finally turned around. It took 3 months for these fucking things to get the fucking Andorra.
This beautiful little mountain hideaway, the post to get here.
You should have seen the ladies.
I got postcards from a mate in Switzerland in February Christmas cards. I got them in February.
Dude, I went down to the post office in Singleton to mail them, and there's a beautiful old lady there called Lynn, right? And I deal with her a lot. She's soul of the earth. And she went, where's this Andorra? I said, that's Andorra. It's a part of Spain. No, it's part of France, right?
Yeah, technically, yeah.
Technically, right. And she goes, oh, it's a tax haven.
Between the two, yeah.
It's a tax haven. She goes, oh, I must be full of criminals.
Well, yeah. MotoGP riders and Simon.
But I'm glad it got there. I hope you enjoy them. Just you know, moving away from me plugging my own fucking books, but how do you see the rest of the season? Is it even possible to predict this? Because, you know, I'm in a tipping comp which looks like a fucking mad woman shit at the moment, right? It's, no one can pick anything.
I'm coming last in that again.
Yeah, it's rubbish. Oh, terrible.
I actually got told I was part of that guru, you know, picking the every session. And I didn't get asked, and I fully threw my toys out of the pram and refused because, I mean, for the first, there's about three reasons. First, you've heard of it, right? The guru.
Yeah. Yep.
That game, you know, you can win a Panigale. I mean, I'd love the Panigale, but the thing is, first of all, I don't want to do anything unless I can do it well. And to do picking, you know, who's going to be fastest in each session and win the race and podium, you have to invest a lot of time to think about every angle, what the bike, the circuit, the tires,
yeah.
Who does history. And that to me steals from my job.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, I don't want to invest all that time on that for a game. I mean, I don't want to because I have to, it's going to detract from my work. And then second, if I'm interviewing someone at Park Fermé, they know, they know that I picked him, and I never pick him. No, it doesn't look
good. Simon, it's also like trying to deconstruct a beautiful poem. You know,
your poems.
Yeah, my poem is magnificent, right? But it's trying to deconstruct, you know, a glorious poem. And we used to do this in English class. You know,
yeah, you're right.
They take a poem.
But if you got one.
Nah, not tonight, I don't think.
Okay.
No, I've already done one, but it's deconstructing, you know, a glorious thing like that. Nah, fuck it. You know, it's shits and giggles for me, but what do you think?
The final reason is you can't pick it.
No.
Incredible.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it.
So, okay, but generally how are you inclined? I want to know how you're inclined.
In other words, is Pecco going to win again?
I mean, he should. Like, he's the best guy on the best bike, you know, out of all the Ducati is still the best machine, and Pecco is the reference. All the other riders say that Pecco is our reference. We look at his data. What he does on the bike is awesome. Like, so yeah, in my mind he should, you know, but this is, it's mental, isn't it? You know, like as he said, without the sprints, he'd be well behind right now because he hasn't done well in the GPs with the crashes, you know? So I think all I can do is like, I think that the KTM's not going to go everywhere well because they'll still have some weaknesses at, for example, what I'm waiting to see is how well they go at Assen, you know, places like Assen, Phillip Island, that are all about flowing rather than stop-start because they're obviously good at the stop-start. But the other thing is they are only going to get better. They've got a whole lot of new bits and they're fine-tuning it now. You know, they haven't, they've only had it for five races and they're still figuring it out. I can't see the Honda problem getting much better during through this year because of the reasons I said. You're not allowed to change the engine, and I think the core of the problem is that, and pretty much same with Yamaha, you know. So let's hope they bring something. But so I think it's going to be between the European manufacturers mostly, apart from a few brilliant rides from the Japanese manufacturers' riders, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, Marquez remains the linchpin there, I think.
Yeah, and but the last thing is what we saw from Mav. Please bring it again,
yes, because, fuck yes.
Like, I mean, he, like, there's circuits coming up that the Aprilia is good at. And I would say probably the first one coming up is Germany, you know, Assen.
Yep.
There's the best bike there last year, Phillip Island. There's one other I've forgotten. But, yeah, those circuits, it should be the best bike there. And let's see if Mav and hopefully Oliveira's back. I think we're going to see some really good results from Aprilia's coming up.
Yeah, well, the Beast is also due to come back soon too.
I hope so. God.
I didn't miss
Karen on the Beast.
There, actually, he's going to have some good ones. But sorry, yeah, the Beast will be back. Poor bugger. He's it's not like it's a lot more than even Mark's now, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, time off. So,
well, it's a scapula that you don't often break a scapula.
Yeah.
It's a bastard of a thing to break because it's one of those real bastards. You can't do anything with it. It's going to heal it.
Yeah. Like a scaphoid bad blood feed, I think.
Yeah.
It takes a while to come back.
All right, but, mate. Yeah, listen. Thank you. Thank you so much for once again, you know, gracing us with your glorious knowledge and insight and that, mate. It's an absolute joy and pleasure to have you on the show.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. I look forward to your podcast every week. So, bye for now.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Thanks, mate.